there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hey everyone, a few episodes back we covered pacing in stories and how writing a page turner is about more than just inserting a bunch of exciting events. And this got us thinking about other forms of entertainment that rely on engaging the audience. Namely, we're thinking video games. Like, how does a video game keep us glued to the screen for hours on end? Turns out there's a lot of different aspects. We interviewed three professionals from the game industry, and each had their own take on exactly how pacing works in video games. But before we get to the interview, I want to talk about Patreon. Patreon is a way for you, the listener, to support creators like us through small monthly donations. And as a thank you, Patreon subscribers get access to our bonus podcasts, which is usually an in-depth workshop on one of our exercises. We have a lot of fun discussing, but also learning about what works and doesn't work in a piece of writing. We've made a couple of the bonus podcasts free, so you can check them out if you go over to patreon.com/wordstowritebypodcast. And now onto the interviews.
Hi, my name is Lorenzo Pelosini. I wrote two novels, and most recently during COVID, I started working as a script writer for video games, essentially interactive graphic novels on app form, and they're called Demons in High Heels and Demons of New York.
How important is pacing in designing a video game?
Well, it's pretty much everything. The sad truth is that no one is going to listen if you bore them to death. So pacing is the very first thing you need to learn in terms of format. Everything else can be understood over time, but pacing is required from day one because every story has its own pacing depending on what we're talking, what we're discussing, what we're telling.
So when you're designing video games, sometimes do you try to slow them down?
It all depends. Time is always malleable when we're writing. And yes, at times, especially when we're talking about what I call the character moments, yes, you need to indulge and slow down, but you always need to let the reader know or the player know that you know exactly what will bore them. So if you're slowing it down, then remember to make it faster right after.
Are there pacing mechanisms that are unique to video games?
Not to the video games I work on, as in the pacing techniques that I use are the same ones as you could find in any visual media. So the point is always manipulation of time. It comes from the awareness of being in charge of time, that time is entirely relative and entirely in your hands.
Right, because when you're reading a novel, you really don't know how fast somebody can read. But when you've got them on a screen, you control how fast they're seeing what comes, right?
Precisely. And in both cases, there are some moments that need to breathe, like good wine, and other moments that need to be experienced in a very, very fast pace. For instance, action does not need to be understood in its entirety. You know, if there is a building that is collapsing, we don't need to see every single glass breaking. That's not what we're there for. It needs to be clear enough and slow enough so that we understand where we are, but not slow enough that we can understand everything around us, because we're trying to discuss chaos in that specific instance. In other instances, I write a lot of love moments and romantic situations for the video games I write, and that requires time to become more intimate, as I say, and that requires to linger on details. So in that moment, we need to understand how soft someone's hand can be, and how her hair or his hair can smell. So those things require time, and time slows down.
My name is Lydia Simchich. I am a video game designer, and I've worked in positive impact games, and I want to go into narrative design.
So your current job is less narrative development, but have you had some experience doing narrative development?
Yeah, tons. What's great about video games is that you have so many more avenues to show, not tell. I end up trying to pull in a lot of narrative elements in all of my game design, even if it's not explicitly a story game. If there's a character who comes in, what are they like? How are they behaving? What is their body language like? What is the sound that is around you as you are working, whether it's ambient sound or sound effects or music? I think all of these elements that come from different departments, they tie together to make the sense of a world, a character, a reason for you being there, which are ultimately all narrative.
How important is pacing for video games?
It's really important. The reason why it is so important is that with games, you have a player who can do any number of things. Everything is either opt-in or you're forcing them to listen. You need to balance that idea of, well, we want them to opt-in so they're not forced to do something, or we really need the player to know this. Are we going to force them to sit through something like a cutscene or a monologue, etc.? Are there ways to do this that the player will inevitably experience, but is not going to take away the player's agency for a moment?
What are some tricks you have available in a video game to control pacing that are not available in a traditional narrative form?
I think it really is exploration and experimentation. That is the core behind mechanics like crafting, but behind like finding secret spaces, finding audio logs, all of these mechanics where we can deliver narrative through explicitly saying or having someone speak for themselves, found objects, object descriptions, store descriptions, stuff like that. Ultimately, it stems from the ability for the player to explore at their leisure the area where they are and the curiosity that one would have to then find more or to pass on. The thing about a book is that you really do have to think about how you're going to be delivering it because there is only one way to go through it. With a video game, you can have multiple branches or you can have an open exploration. That freedom, of course, comes with a lot more stress of trying to make sure that it makes sense and is in a right order. It is really nice to be able to say, well, okay, well, this doesn't quite work as writing, or this doesn't quite work as a sound. Could we put this in the environment somewhere? Those options of how you pepper environment into the story then goes hand in hand with level design or with structuring the paths that one can take. So you can place those little details or you can have those landmarks as you are physically moving through the game.
What sorts of stuff do you do to like make a game gripping and actionful to the player?
Ooh, ambiance and some tricks you can do with ambiance to make it feel more intense, even if it isn't. What I mean ambiance is things like sound development, visual effects, like establishing a structure in the level where there's only one way to go, but because the ground is shaking, you can hear something chasing you, like you know that you need to go forward. That is all you care about in that moment. There are some ways that you can actually use tropes to your advantage. The one that comes to mind is there's a joke or a common theme among horror game design where they give you the instruction of how you run in the game. That's a bad sign. That means you're going to have to run soon because they wouldn't be telling you how to run if they didn't expect you to run soon. I think that's also the feeling of if you hear very intense music, you know a boss is on its way. So some of that is building the anticipation for the moment. There are very much emotional elements as well. In longer form games, you end up getting very attached to the characters. in larger world games where you start in one village and then you travel the world and you end up coming back to that village, it feels nostalgic. And you're like, oh, there's the bread seller on the corner just where he was. So there are definitely emotional beats too that can either add some intensity and some direness. Like if one of those NPCs is in trouble now, when you go back to the village, it's destroyed where you just were not 10 hours ago, but also give moments of rest.
Hi, I'm Allison Salmon, and I'm a senior game engineer at Filament Games. And I'm also an instructor for the University of California, Irvine in the Game Design and Interactive Media program.
So you're more on the programming side of things than the big picture design stuff?
Currently, yes, though I've been in a lot of different roles and a lot of different size companies.
And what kind of games were those? How would you describe them?
So Creative Kingdoms did live action games and attractions for resorts and amusement parks. Our biggest product was MagiQuest, which is in all of the Great Wolf resorts. It's like a role-playing game. There's like a lot of lore and story to it. You go on quests, usually culminate in some kind of big boss battle.
And how important was pacing for those sorts of games?
So pacing is kind of a challenge for MagiQuest, especially, or resorts and attractions games, because people play them in very different ways than they would play even just a at-home game, because they're in a resort. So like they might go on a couple of quests and then have dinner or go to the water park. Pacing was very hard to control for that. But we did actually do data analysis about it. Like, that's one of the great things about video games is you can get data. I actually wrote a bunch of tools where we would look at the completion time of individual quests and then the whole arc of a quest. Be like, you have to find these three things and then I'll give you this rune. And you needed like three runes in order to fight the troll or the goblin. We would aim to have people complete at least one of those in one playtime. We'd want them to complete at least one whole one during a weekend stay. For Magic Quest, they were given a magical wand, like a physical magical wand. And then you'd wave it at stations with a screen that would talk to you and give you quests, but also physical objects around the resort. So a treasure chest. The treasure chest would open, you'd hear that you found, you know, 50 gold pieces or whatever.
So the different parts of that game, there was like an exploration part, and then there was an actual fight. Were there storylines as well woven into that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There was a sort of predetermined order in which you should be doing the quests. There's a little bit of a flexibility to it, but if you complete all the quests, you get the whole story.
As far as the data that you gathered, could you tell how engaged people were at different stages of the quest?
It was a little bit tricky. You sort of have to read into why they stopped. Mostly our players were kids. The sweet spot for this game, I think, was 8 at the youngest to teenagers at the oldest. And so you don't know if their parents were just like, yep, it's time for dinner. We gotta go.
So in our podcast, we talked about how you can control pacing with like action that's very fast paced, but then you have slower paces where people are more contemplative and they think about stuff. Do you use any of those correlate to game design, either what you were doing with the Magic Quest or other game design?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely correlates a lot to games, not like Magic Quest, but games you'd play at your house on your computer or your PlayStation or your Xbox. I mean, there's a huge range in games, obviously. Like some games have no narrative at all. They're purely mechanics driven. A lot of games you'd play on your mobile device, Bejeweled or Candy Crush, right? Like, sure, maybe there's a map and there's a Candy King guy, but I don't think anybody knows like a deep plot line of Candy Crush. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's games that are just purely narrative games. There's a guy, Mike Bithell, who makes Thomas Was Alone, but now he makes these other games that are just narrative, where you're just talking to characters and they have branching narratives. And those are paced much more like any novel. And then you have those ones like God of War or like even the plot lines of Call of Duty, single player or things like that. Those have a story, but then they also have these segments of just action. And those generally have pretty fully developed storylines. The single player experience has a lot of those same elements of narratives that you would encounter, like parts where there's rising action and falling action. You know, after a big boss battle, they want you to have a little bit of a breather for a while so that people don't get frustrated and it doesn't feel like it's constantly just bombarding you with challenges. Games do it a bit clunky sometimes. Sometimes it just feels like the narrative is stuck in between the fight scenes.
So that does change the pacing, the mix between the action scenes and the cut scenes, even if they're just done clunky. But there are other mechanisms that are unique to games that maybe you wouldn't have. Like I was reading that when a character is doing exploration, it's a different pacing level than when they're doing something that's directly related to getting to the boss to fight, correct? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it goes pretty deeply into the disciplines of level design for games, where you're telling a story not just with words, but with a physical space and using the space to help with the pacing.
The actual space of the level affects the pacing that the player gets through.
And there's a lot about level design too, where you're even leading people through a space with visual cues to the story. If you're in a game where you're looking for somebody or something and there's like little clues around the space, level designers will often use things like lighting in the level to illuminate, like, this is the path to go down. Like, how do you know which part of the jungle you can walk through? Well, it's the one with the giant sunbeam hitting it.
I know something like Zelda Breath of the Wild had an enormous world, and it felt like you could go anywhere in that.
Open worlds can be a big challenge. It is really challenging to tell a story in that medium because players won't do what you want necessarily. Like maybe 80 to 90% of them will, but then there's always like a few players who will just like try to do something completely different with your game. I watched a really long YouTube video once of a guy just trying to play Grand Theft Auto without committing a crime. And it was exceedingly hard for him because like everything in the game mechanics is geared towards you.
Steal your car.
He was just trying to walk around the city and like pay for things. So there's always people who will do that.
Those darn pacifists.
It's also really challenging to tell a story and still give the player enough agency to feel like they're making choices. Because that's why they play a game instead of reading a novel, is because they want to live it in some way or experience it and have control over it. There are a lot of games that feel very much like, okay, I have dialogue choices, but do any of these really matter? Or do I just go through all of them till I get all the information? Am I really making any choices? You know, sometimes that's very frustrating with games.
Thank you to all our guests. You can find out more about their projects on our website show notes page. That's www.wordstowritebypodcast.com. Also, in the continuing the conversation part of our show notes, Renee shares more information about video game narratives. Back to the world of novel narratives, we're going hard in on the plots this episode. Every composition class will give you that rising-falling action graph. But how do you translate that to words on paper? Unsurprisingly, according to Bickham, it's done through structure. We're going to go through his 7 different plot structures and why they keep the readers engaged. Next, we'll try to make sense of what Bickham means when he says backstory and hidden story. Finally, subplots. Everyone loves a good subplot, but how do you fit them into a novel? We've got a lot to cover this episode, so let's get going.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 26. Can you believe it?
That's crazy sauce. We are getting darn close to the end of this. Like, I think we're in the part of the book where, like, most people don't even get to.
Yeah, definitely.
when I first started this book, I don't know, a few years ago, I abandoned it 4 chapters before this point now. So this is pretty good.
I kind of feel like this is that special thing for everyone that's lasted long enough. Now they start to get some really good stuff. You know, like for all our listeners who have listened this far, now you have earned plotting with scene and sequel. So we're no longer just talking about like little bits that you're writing. We're talking about the whole book.
So how to put together like the whole story question, not just the dramatic conflict within one scene. It's the dramatic conflict with the whole book and how these scene and sequels come together to create the ultimate novel.
It's like we've been doing Karate Kid, wax on, wax off, and now suddenly.
Oh my God, it's so true. Yes. Yes, wax on, wax off.
Okay, so starts off with, first I'll be a little patting yourselves on the back, all the stuff you've learned before, but then we get to dramatic principles and devices. The question every writer asks, how can I make sure the reader isn't getting bored?
Good question.
The other question every writer says is, how the heck am I going to actually write this next section? But we'll assume that we've gotten that worked out.
Yeah, yeah. So in the very beginning, he talks about organizing your scenes and your sequels together to create a larger narrative, right? And you do that, one, through dramatic principles and devices to make sure that your reader doesn't get bored. So essentially, he says, a well-organized story has an inexorable forward movement, which will sweep the reader along, and there will simply be no place where the reader can relax and hop off.
Bickham's idea is plot is good, interesting characters are good, but what really is going to keep the reader turning the page is the structure that all this is being delivered.
And in here, he doesn't really remake the wheel at all. He just talks about rising action. You know, he goes back to Aristotle. They all do. I guess dude figured it out early on. The good stories have a nice, you know, forward momentum that goes upwards in conflict. And then usually a quick resolution at the end. And so Bickham just joins that club and says, make sure you put your scenes in order of rising dramatic tension. And then that's going to make your reader worry. And then thereby making your reader want to keep reading.
And then he helpfully gives us a set of templates for different plots that do this. So we went through and read what his definitions were. And then since he doesn't actually give any examples in here.
Yeah.
He does. He goes back to that guy climbing the mountain.
Yeah. Okay. So I kind of wish he would talk about more books. That is my key complaint here, is that he does not talk about examples that are helpful to a novelist, right. i.e. putting in more novel examples.
Right. But I will say that given the age of this book, my guess is if he did put in examples, there'd be books we'd never heard of.
I don't know. I'm a big fan of examples. The first ones, he says, are the scenes will move the viewpoint character farther and farther away from any quick shortcut to the original goal. Pretty clear cut.
Linking back to the interview earlier about how video games people do plot is, did you ever do the old Sierra games? They were like King's Quest, Hero's Quest. Anyway, they were like non-button mashing games. They were actually quest games. And what would happen is you would show up on the island and you had to rescue the princess, but you couldn't get into the castle. And so you're wandering around, but you needed some money. So what you did was you found a chicken that you fed the chicken and it laid a golden egg and you brought the golden egg. And so it was a series of these little things you need to do and achieve to get to the final goal. So that's what I was thinking about for this one.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I mean, I thought of the most obvious answer, Lord of the Rings, when Frodo and Sam are at the borders of Mordor. They're so close. And then they're not. They keep getting pulled back and they can't get into Mordor. So that's what I figured out. But that one's such a basic.
It very much is the little things you build up to get the final bit. So I think it also you get a little bit like with screwball comedies where a whole bunch of small things are going on. And then in the end, they all gather together.
Would you say that this number one here is just a standard hero's journey?
Well, he used the example of that woman and the pig.
The fairy tale.
Yeah, because each of those things clicked together to make the whole thing work. Because I think in the second one, with the series of disasters, that almost feels a little bit more like the hero's journey. It's not like daisy chained as much. It's one thing after another they have to overcome.
Okay, so well, let's do number two then.
Okay, yeah, so number two.
Number two. The scenes will develop through a series of disasters, which heap new and unexpected woes on the character's head, but do not obviously relate to one another.
Right.
So this is where things can get kind of crazy, where it's like you start out just going out for a croissant for breakfast, and then you end up in another dimension, time portal, on another planet, becoming, I don't know.
Right. Or Indiana Jones.
I wrote down Indiana Jones. Yeah. I also, Thor Ragnarok. My buddy Greg. Hey, Greg. He gave me that idea because Thor, he just wants to see his dad. And then his sister comes around. And then he just wants to save his homeland. But then he ends up, you know, in an arena on a weird planet. Like,
yes, just one thing after all. It even starts with him captured.
Yeah.
With this little minor quest that then leads to the next step.
Right. I thought of another one. It's been a while. I don't know. This reveals our age, dear listener. Romancing the Stone. You remember that movie?
I remember seeing bits and pieces of it.
It was lovely. It was about a very shy, probably social anxiety disordered woman writing a romance novel. And then she ends up on this wild adventure with this guy who pretty much is someone she would write about in her book.
My example for this one was Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, which is one of the series of Oz books. There's a set of people out there who have read all 14, plus some of the extras afterwards. And then everybody else that says, huh, there's one after the... Anyway, so Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz starts off with Dorothy meeting the wizard in our world and somehow getting transported to a fantasy world. And they end up going underground and they keep going further and further. And there's one thing that stops them and another thing that stops them. And the idea is that it's just one thing after another until he pulls out a MacGuffin to get them out of there.
These plots are akin to like a slot machine, right? I thought it kind of like tapped into that animal primate part of our brain that's looking for novelty, why you're addicted to your phone. I feel like that's what these plots are. Such crazy novel things happen to these characters that you can't stop reading.
Yeah. They overcome one thing and then there's another thing coming at them.
Yeah. What's number three?
Number three is a new goal gets in the way.
Okay, so he says that the scenes will develop in such a way that the hero must take on some entirely unrelated shorter-term goal quest to clear the decks for an eventual return to the original storyline. I thought of Dune. The original story quest was to establish his family as the rulers of Arrakis, to take control of the spice. And then Paul, you know, his dad dies and he gets thrown out with his mom out into the desert and he ends up becoming the Kwisatz Haderach. And,
you know, I'm so impressed that you can say that.
It just shows how much of a nerd I am. I've seen the movie many times and I've read the book many times. So he ends up essentially winning in the end, doing the thing he set out to do, gain control of Arrakis.
But he has this whole detour where he joins the nomads and he had no plans to actually do that or become their ruler or use their army to defeat the Baron Harkonnen.
Yeah.
Okay, so next one is interweaving patterns. So where you have plots and subplots that most relate in some distant way to the central quest, says Bickham, but may not have an obvious link.
So this is where a book toggles between different viewpoint characters. The most obvious, everyone's probably thinking of it, is Game of Thrones. But the key here is to know that there's usually one character that gets most of the viewpoint time in a book. So in Game of Thrones, most people would argue that the story, although is split between, you know, Tyrion, Jaime, Arya, various other characters, really it's Jon Snow's story.
With kind of that one time where you split the book in two, where it was more Arya's story.
There you go. So, you know, Game of Thrones is just hops from character to character and they come back to other characters, right? But maybe lesser known is Poisonwood Bible.
The Poisonwood Bible has four sisters that their father takes them to Africa. He's a missionary. And then it follows each of their storylines. And two of them are twins. one of the two twins, we haven't decided which one would be the main character, either the one that goes back to the United States and becomes a scientist and overcomes her disability, or the other sister that ends up marrying a teacher there and then lives her entire life in the Congo trying to protect her children.
The key here is to know that the viewpoint characters take turns telling the story.
The interweaving pattern idea heightens the tension because you have one character that gets to a certain point, and then you switch to another character. Bickham says the reason why you keep reading at that point is you want to get back to that first character and find out what the heck happens to them. My example was Elena Fernata's My Brilliant Best Friend. And this one only has two character points of view. And in many ways, it's Elena's friend, whose name I forget, Lila. Lila has the most dramatic storyline. She's the one that breaks everything up and does all these things. And Elena's storyline is a little bit more secondary, but we are following the character of Elena very closely too. When she's got her own story arc and her own things that she discovers by herself. And Fernanda does this trick where she figures out ways to weave in Lila's story, even though it's not told from Lila's perspective, like a journal entry or some letter written or whatever. But again, when you're reading it, it's very clearly that Elena is the main force, even though it's called My Brilliant Best Friend.
And then number five.
The clock is ticking.
Tick, tock, tick, tock. Okay, so yeah, it's a ticking time bomb, literally.
I chose the movie High Noon.
Oh, yep, that'll do
it. High Noon. It's an old Western. The director actually decided to time it out. It starts at like 11 o'clock and it runs for an hour and it ends at noon at this confrontation with this bad guy. And there's all these little incidental things that lead up to it, but it's always in the background that the sheriff is going to have to face the bad guy in a shootout.
It's going to happen and he can't get out of it. Well, he could leave, right? That's the one where he could leave in the beginning, but he decides he's going to stay.
Yeah, but like throughout the movie, you catch signs of a clock or you hear the ticking and it's all played out through. Bickham's point here is that that will heighten the tension.
Yeah. And no matter what, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's going to go through.
Next one is the options dwindle. And so this is raising tension because, you know, there are fewer and fewer ways for them to get out.
Yeah.
I couldn't come up with a really good one, but one I thought of was in Howl's Moving Castle. As they're being attacked, they start off with this giant castle, but they keep losing more and more of it until finally it's like a single platform on legs running along and it's tinier and tinier. And I thought that was a good example of this because they're trying to get somewhere, but also their mode of transportation is disappearing on them.
Right. He didn't really have a real example. He just said, you know, there are only two things left I can see to try, and they both look miserable to me. If they both fail, what am I to do? Will it mean I'm finished? Right, so that's the best Bickham could do here. Howl's Moving Castle was a really good example.
Nice visual. Just you can feel the tension of that scene because they're losing their place to stand.
That's a metaphor, right? You have this castle, and if your character's options are falling apart like the castle, then it's filling this dramatic principle.
Yep. Final one is plot complications. He says, it's an author's holdout. So the example he gives is someone that you didn't know is the bad guy, and they're pulling all the strings.
Yeah, some character who seems like a minor player in the early parts of the book did some terrible deed 10 years before the time of this novel, and now he is himself like a ticking time bomb.
Right.
You know, the only example I could come up with in my head, I guess maybe I just don't really read a lot of stories like this, a Knives Out.
Right. And that's common with a mystery, you know. Often it's somebody that is very mild all the way through that suddenly turns out to be the one. That's what's brilliant about the detective, because they look at all the suspects and they notice that one person.
Yeah, there's like this secret that is pulling all the strings, like you said. Yeah.
Well, I got a great one for this.
What'd you come up with?
Gone Girl.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That is a poster child for this type of plot.
Right. And all of a sudden, all those clues that you had about who she was are just turned on their head.
Right. So if you haven't seen the movie and you haven't read the book,
we spoiled it for you. So I like these templates because they're general enough that you could identify one of these that your story fits in. If you know which template you have, you say, well, oh, obviously, you know, like multiple disasters, you know, I haven't had a disaster in a while. Obviously, that's what I need to do to keep raising this tension.
But can you fit every book into one of these?
I mean,
like a memoir? I mean, does it really fit?
Memoirs often have several disasters. I mean, there's something that would cause you to keep turning the page, right?
They do say that you have to take your experience and turn it into a story, right? You have mm-hmm. to turn it into something rising and falling action.
Memoirs need rising action, right?
They do. But I don't know if mine fits in any of these, which might be a problem or maybe not, because I'm actually having a hard time thinking of a memoir I've read, and I've read quite a few that follow these.
Well, you have a series of disasters in a lot of memoirs.
I guess,
right?
That's the first one, right?
Yeah. But I mean, like, A Clock Is Ticking could be your mother's dying of cancer.
That's true.
It doesn't have to be like over the top. It can be toned down because a memoir is so personal, even small things. A series of disasters for you personally could simply be being in a car accident or having a friend pass away. Like, things that, because it's so personal, it means a lot more than for an action hero.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so then from that, we go on to...
This is where it gets interesting, I think, because I'm actually trying to figure this out. So he says every narrative is really composed of three parts. The backstory, the present story, and the hidden story. I thought that was fascinating. So let's do the backstory.
I've heard that you start your story as close to the end as you can. Basically, there's a whole bunch of other plot that comes before that is your backstory. So everything that happens before your story starts, everything that leads up to it is mm-hmm. the backstory.
Right.
And what he says is that you may never tell the backstory linearly from the very beginning, but you know what that backstory is.
So I'm assuming if you know what the backstory is, that can help you define maybe what your character's goals are, what their motivations are, all that kind of stuff, right?
Right. Also, like, where the disasters are going to come in.
World building. If you know the backstory, even though you don't tell it, it helps shape the world that they're in as well.
Exactly. It makes it real. I mean, everyone's life has a backstory up to the present moment. So your characters should have one too.
Okay. So, I mean, it would probably be, in case you haven't figured out the backstory of your character, maybe do like a couple free writes to figure out what it is. And that might kind of make the book richer.
It's both a wonderful form of procrastination and it actually gives you material to work from.
So this is why I haven't finished my book, dear listener. Okay. So then he goes on to the present story. This one's pretty easy. It's the story that's going on right now in the book.
Yeah. The one that you're telling.
But this is the one I'm fascinated by it and yet confused at the same time. It's the hidden story. And he says the hidden story also takes place during the present time of the story action, but it is composed of things that happen to or are done by characters outside of the viewpoint character's knowledge. He says careful planning of the hidden story must involve imagining scenes and sequels involving characters offstage at the moment the present story is being played on the stage. What? Why? What would be the point of this?
Look at it this way. You live your own life, but around you, other people are living their lives, and occasionally they interact with you in unexpected ways. So something trivial like, you know, you're going to get your hair cut to go and look really nice at this formal event, but your hairdresser is sick that day, and so someone else cuts your hair, and it's all messed up.
Okay.
In that case, there's a hidden story because it's not just that you went and had a bad hair day and went to this event. The writer needs to know the reason why your hair is cut badly is because the regular person wasn't there.
Does the reader need to know this story?
That's the thing. From the reader's perspective, all they know is that Renee shows up, her hairdresser isn't there, and she gets a bad haircut.
Oh.
But you as the writer need to have this logical understory, the hidden story, to support everything else. Because otherwise you just have random stuff showing up. Here's the example I was thinking of. There's the movie The Dark Knight. You know, everyone says the best Joker ever, Heath Ledger, directed by Christopher Nolan. And part of what makes him so scary is that, like, he's got all these things that keep popping up to stop the hero. But we never actually explain how this guy that's basically just got out of mental asylum has managed to bring in so many competent people to set bombs at particular locations so they go off. Like, he's commanding an army. And there's no reason that he should actually have an army to command. So one of the problems I've always run into that movie is that he's not a realistic villain, not because he's not evil or not because he's not brilliantly acted, but because it makes no sense that he should have these resources to take over the city. Because there's no hidden story there. It's just like he snaps his finger and somehow some underling comes up with the right bomb to set off in this location.
Right. And so the movie The Joker then is the hidden story turned into the backstory. Because that explains why he has that whole army. later.
Oh, that movie had how he got the whole army?
Well, it lays the foundation for how it probably came about.
I mean, comic books by themselves always have the villains have outsized resources to actually do the bad stuff they do.
Right. It isn't always explained why they
have. No, it's never explained how they have enough money to hire the thugs to do these operations, how they happen to just have that one particular poison that they need to drop in the water system. So comic books don't often have as much of a hidden story.
No, they do have a hidden story. They don't have backstory.
No, they have tons of backstory.
I'm confused. So these characters have resources, but we don't know where they came from. That's the hidden story.
Right. But what I'm saying is it was not plotted out how the Joker got all the resources.
Oh, you're saying it's a flaw in the kind of storytelling.
Yes. And comic books in general, the bad guy shows up where he needs to be and does all the damage. Often comic books are really good at what the backstory is, why this person is doing this thing. But the actual logistics of how you would acquire all these resources to cause these problems. You know, I used to work in a lab. They're bloody expensive. And you need a top-notch lab manager to make sure you're ordering all your ingredients so you can do your various experiments. It's not like something that you just like pull off the shelf and you suddenly have made a mutation serum that does something. Comic books don't often have as much of a hidden story. Whereas like a legal procedural has a very exacting, or whenever someone does research into something and, you know, says they happen to know what bureaucratic setup of New York in 1960 was, that's a hidden story.
Okay. I think I'm still kind of confused. The backstory, is that something that actually does end up somehow in the story, whereas the hidden story doesn't, even though those details were mapped out somehow for the writer?
I think that you think of the hidden story as a framework, and it might be revealed at a certain point, but because you've worked out the details of the hidden story, it's all plausible that stuff is happening.
Okay, so you're just trying to figure out the logic of things going on, whereas the backstory, it may or may not make its way into the story.
Or I was thinking about the interviews we did last week with the writers and their outlines. One person, she had a single timeline and she had all the stuff that the protagonist was doing, but she had set those other people were doing during that time. So when she was looking to say, well, my character's meeting up with this one person, but in my hidden timeline, they were two states over 3 hours ago. Could they actually make it in time to meet up with a hero at this point?
Okay. So it's the physics.
Yeah. And for you writing a memoir, it's not as important because everything actually happened, right?
No, actually, I think this is why I'm trying to understand it very clearly, because one of my issues with the book, which I might just have to leave out at this point, is that there was information I did not know as a child that I ended up learning later through various ways. You know, one was I found some stuff hidden in my grandmother's drawer that revealed a few family details that I was like, I did not know these things. And then that helped me stitch together a later memory like, oh my God, that's the reason why this happened, right? The problem with my life is there's lots of hidden stories that were hidden by specific characters in the story that I find out through weird means later what was going on at the time. So then I have too many choices to make. It's like, well, do I even reveal that stuff later? Do I just talk about it as if I knew that the whole time, or that's just part of the story? Like, I'm not sure how to weave it in a way that fits with the story I want to tell. I actually get really confused because the younger me, these stories were hidden.
And here's the fundamental problem. You're talking about stuff that happened in the past. So they're both hidden stories, but they're also backstory at the same time. It's just a lot mushier than when someone's constructing something off the top of their head and they need to have character A and character B meet. Then they need to know the hidden story to make sure character B is in that location.
Yes. And this is a big problem I'm having. I'm having a hard time separating the two or finding a way to meld the two. Dear listener, if you're writing a memoir or you know how to break this apart, you know, I would be forever in your debt if you hook me up. Let me know how you're figuring it out.
The final section is about interweaving subplots. And I thought this was fantastic, basically because I'd never actually seen someone lay it out in this manner. And as I mentioned before, the idea of a subplot or having multiple plots in a story is you are reading and your hero has gone off a cliff in a disaster and you turn the page and suddenly we're back to his son playing in the playground. It's like, I don't want to find out about this. I want to find out what happens to that guy. And for most of us, we will then proceed to read all about this child in the playground until something dramatic happens to that and we go back to the hero. I'm sure there are other people, especially in your Kindle, will just type in that person's name and get to the next section where they're in. this can backfire for you. Another Game of Thrones reference, but at a certain point, we're sitting on the bed, and my husband's reading the book that I had just finished. And he says, "So, does anything important actually happen in Dorne?" And I said, "No, no, it doesn't." Aww. And he flipped on over.
He skipped it.
He did, because it was just too... So if you do it right, your subplots will keep the audience going. If you do it wrong, you could lose them entirely. So this is his suggestions for how you do subplots. First one is straightforward. You keep with a single person's POV throughout the scene. You don't jump around. We've talked about that in the past, and it makes a lot of sense. It'll keep things a lot clearer. Then the next one is one viewpoint must clearly dominate in your manuscript.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, like Game of Thrones is Jon Snow's story.
Right. Even though you got the other subplots, there's a single hero. Although it was interesting, again, last episode, romance novels have two main characters because you've got the two people that are in love and they are equally balanced between both of them and each of them have their own arc.
Not always. So I'm reading my time travel porn, the Outlander series. Mm-hmm. So it is clearly Claire's story. It does sometimes jump into Jamie's head into a chapter, but it's totally her story.
That's a romance, but it's not pure genre romance, is it? There's like a lot of action adventure in there.
You know, I cannot say with certainty because it's the only romance novel I've ever read.
Well, dear listener, I've read a few more romance novels than Renee. I will say that a properly done romance novel will have both characters have their own goals, their own story arcs, and in the end, they will achieve that happily ever after because they both overcome particular obstacles and they are together.
Well, I mean, Jamie has his own arc and he does do all of that, but the story is clearly Claire's.
Right. But I think that for the specific genre, very strict genre romance, you know, with a woman with the Fabio and the heaving bosom on the surface. I may be about those. A lot of modern romances really do get into both characters' heads, which brings us to number three, which is that your characters have to have obvious different viewpoints. You have to be able to tell who you're reading about at each time. I think most of this is pretty natural. Your characters are different enough, especially if there's one protagonist, they're going to have a different outlook than somebody that has a subplot that maybe isn't as important.
I remember in my South African literature course, we read maybe like 6 to 8 novels. And part of the final was he put 10 sentences randomly selected from all of the novels, and you had to identify the book it came from. And I think also the significance of the line. And I'm wondering if that could be a good test for making sure that your characters' voices sound differently by, you know, just pulling out random lines and seeing if people can tell the difference.
That would be an excellent one. So, like I said, I do read some romance ones, and I found one that was a delightful male-male romance about a boy band and two members of the boy band falling in love with each other. And I loved it. But the problem was is that the two voices were not distinct enough. And especially since they were both male, there were points where I got confused about which person's point of view I was reading about.
I see.
And that was a big negative for the book. I just couldn't quite engage as much as if I had two completely separate viewpoints.
I had an opposite problem with the book. So it was called Armor. The author's last name was Stakely, I believe. There's two narrators. And the first one took up half the book. And it was like, oh, you were so into it. It was amazing. Like, you want adventure on an alien planet and this person fighting for their life. So gripping and so, so good. And then it switched. It kind of left on a cliffhanger and it went to a new point of view. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm thinking, when can I get back to this other guy? And you never do. And the whole time I'm thinking, this guy's story is not nearly as entertaining as the other. So I think that's another thing you have to be careful of. Don't make one character, their story so much better that it overshadows whatever else happens in the book.
Right. That's actually step number four, which is viewpoints ordinarily should be changed only when necessary to enhance the reader's curiosity or suspense. And it sounds like what they did was they pulled the rug out from underneath you. You had this person you were very much engaged in, and suddenly you're reading about a plot you weren't interested in either.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it ended badly and it wasn't entertaining, but it was not as cool as the first part.
Right. He says, fully 90% of your viewpoint changes should be done to heighten the reader's tension. And then he talks about the place to do it as to heighten the tension. So the most common one, he says, is you end it after a disaster. You switch viewpoints. obviously, you know, character goes off a cliff, you turn the page to another character's point of view, and you want to find out what happens in the disaster. The next one he says is in a sequel. Remember, the sequels are that in-between bit between your actual scenes where the character has a chance to process and come up with a new way forward. So after a person has kind of thought out the situation they've just been through, you could also switch at that point to another character because we're leaving them kind of hanging, but like not disaster hanging, but we still don't know where character A is going.
Yeah, and Bickham has an example, which is, you know, the last line of the chapter might be, and then I knew what to do.
And that's the third one. Also, if you want to, you can carry all the way to the end of the sequel until this next action they're going to do. And then you turn the page and go to somebody else. So we don't know how character A's plan is going to play out.
Right.
And then he had just a brilliant little line that is obvious, which is when you go back to character A, you pick up at whatever structural point you left them. So if it's ending on a disaster, you jump to character A's sequel of processing that disaster. If you've ended on the character A's thoughts, then you would come back to them with them basically coming up with their plan is.
Right.
And if you end with them on their sequel with a plan, then you come back to them with them in a scene and coming up with their next set of action and disaster.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. You know, it's funny. I right at the same spot, I found a different good quote. One, okay. It's a t-shirt worthy quote.
Big t-shirt or a little t-shirt?
This is a little t-shirt. So it said, as you plot with multiple viewpoints, you play a suspense game of hopscotch with your reader. I think I just liked the word hopscotch.
The one other little detail he says is just because end on a disaster doesn't mean you have to come back to that character moments after that disaster. You could come back with that character several days after he pulled himself out of the pit. Da-da-da-da-da-da. The beautiful thing about novels is time can pass, but you can still be in the same structure that you were before the next part. Like, a sequel can happen several days after something major happened, or maybe even years after if someone's processing that trauma. When you're going back and forth, it doesn't have to be actual time right after. It could be later, but emotionally it's still tied to what came before. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
And then this last section here, he talks about the scene and sequel content tricks to keep your reader worried. And so he uses, you know, in scene, you know, he says things like, you could drop hints about things the antagonist seems to know, which the viewpoint character doesn't. So it makes me think of like the wolf in Little Red Riding Wolf, or Little Red Riding Hood.
Mm-hmm.
As the reader and the wolf, they know something that Little Red doesn't know.
A lot of these are useful, but again, we're getting to the bucket list.
That's true. And he repeats himself too in the sequel, mm-hmm. Set a clock ticking. Well, okay, we've got that one down.
But what I do think this is excellent for is for an exercise.
Oh, good idea.
We could easily pick one or two of these ideas and take a scene that we have that maybe could be helped along by those ideas or a sequel.
Use one of these content tricks.
Yes, in our own work to see if we can't up the tension.
Yeah, because at the end of this chapter, there is no activity.
No, we're past the point of activities too.
One could argue we are at the event horizon of the book. She keeps me around for a reason. I don't know what it is, but I'm here still somehow.
So before we begin our exercise, we have something we've been trying to help improve our productivity. And Renee's going to tell us about that.
Yeah. So I started using this product called Magic Mind. And it's a supplement drink. It's like a little shot that's got like matcha and like stuff that comes from mushrooms and some turmeric and other stuff. Normally, I'm not into that kind of thing. Like, that's just not me. But Magic Mind contacted us and they told us it might be great for productivity for the kinds of things that we're doing. And so we thought, okay, well, why not try it? So I've been trying it. And I, skeptic as I was, I'm pleasantly surprised.
So are you taking this instead of coffee and tea?
Oh no. I have to drink my coffee. Like, that's a thing. Like, I have to drink my coffee. But I take a lot of supplements. I have a few like weird medical things like everybody does. So I take a lot of vitamin B, because I don't eat meat and I haven't eaten meat for a very long time. And I take a lot of magnesium. I do a lot of running. So I take a lot of stuff like that. Anyway, there's a few things that I take for other, a variety of other medical concerns. So my problem is I get very tired. I have a sleep disorder that requires me to sleep in the machine at night. And it's hard, you know, to sometimes always keep it on. And I get tired in the morning. I wake up. It's hard for me to get out of bed. And it's hard for me to be motivated because I have a few of these issues going on. I'm not saying that this product fixes those things, but I'm always tired. Let's just say that. Like, I'm always trying to fend off the sleepy. So I start trying this product. You know, it's not bad. It actually like keeps me going for a long period of time. Like, I still drink my coffee, but what I do is I drink it right in the morning. I drink it with my breakfast. And it feels like I'm being sustained throughout the day.
So you're starting with coffee and then you're having this at the same time, or?
Yeah. So I wake up in the morning and I make my cereal. I have this keto cereal I eat. And then I start brewing my coffee. And while I'm eating, I take a shot of this stuff.
Now, the stuff is green. I was never a very good vegetable eater. Does it taste green?
What does that mean? Taste green.
Like, does it taste like spinach or something like that?
No. I mean, okay. I also am a little put off by green. It reminds me of kale, and I'm not a fan of kale. Sorry, dear listener. This is surprisingly not gross. It actually tastes pretty good. I'm surprised. Like, it tastes good if you take it in a shot. I've also added it to water. Like, they suggest putting it on like some water with some ice. And I did that. And actually, that's pretty good. It's not bad. It's got kind of a semi-sweet flavor. It's got some honey in it, but not so much that I wouldn't have it. Like, I always try to like watch my carb level, and there's not a lot of honey in it. Just enough to sweeten it. It's really actually pretty tasty.
And how long have you been taking it?
I've been taking it for about 6 days now, 6 or 7 days. And I mean, I can feel it kind of ramping up. Like, I'm surprised. So it takes me a while to wake up in the morning. And some days I'm more energetic than others. Also depends on how many miles I run that morning. But, oh, that's another thing. Like, you know, with my running schedule, like after like an hour or two, I try to wait for my body to digest my breakfast. The Magic Mind, I think, is helping me with the running. I know there are certain supplements I was taking when I was doing like lots of running, like ultra marathons and stuff. And I'm not doing that right now. And I'm trying to ramp up my miles. And I feel like the Magic Mind is really helping. It's like really good. But most importantly, it's after the run. That's the problem. Because after I get back from running, then I start to get tired. Right. And then if I eat lunch, life's over. All bets are off. Lunch has happened. So this kind of helps with that like post-lunch lull.
And so as part of the sponsorship, we have a discount link for people that are interested in giving this Magic Mind a try.
Oh, yeah. So they gave me this cool code that you guys can use. It's www.magicmind.co/words. And you get 40% off your subscription for the next 10 days with this code.
Words20. That's words20.
And your code will be valid forever. It's 20% off for both one-time purchases and subscriptions. But in the first 10 days, it's 40% off if applied to a subscription. So there you go.
Awesome.
I mean, I thought it was pretty good. Tastes pretty good. Gets you off your butt. Makes you focus. Not bad.
Well, let's see if it helped with writing your exercise. Let's get to that now.
Oh, yes. Exercise time.
When I first started trying to figure out what I was going to do, it was almost like I had too many choices. Like, I had, you know, 10 different things I could do to increase the tension, and I could choose any scene that I wanted to. And then I was looking like, none of them fit. Like the first one about drop the hints about things the antagonist seems to know, which the viewpoint character doesn't. I'm like, there's no point where I've got an antagonist that knows something my viewpoint characters don't. How do I work that in? I realize, okay, what I need to do is just, you know, maybe start with a scene and then see if the scene fits any of these ones, and then I'll go and try to make it better. And that's what I did.
In some ways, this is kind of good because that list of dramatic techniques can be rather exhausting, and you don't want to use all of them anyway. So you've probably already naturally using one. So I guess if you've got this book or you're going through the list on our website, you can just find the one that already fits what you're kind of doing.
And then just get really serious about making sure you do that.
Yeah.
In the end, I chose Number three for in a scene. So it says, show new information in the scene which makes it clear that your viewpoint character had faulty intelligence coming in and assumed something that is not so. So I found a scene where new information comes forth that they were not aware of to begin with. This is from my People Go to a Fantasy World novel, and this is right about the time where they have been conscripted to help a woman find her sheep that have wandered off. She also has a giant dog that helps them get to where they're going to look for the sheep. There's a number of characters in here. Just assume that anyone with a normal name is from our world, and the dog's name is Basil, and the woman's name is Mavel. And this one is first person from Kyle. He's somebody from our world's perspective. Basil lands us on a meadow halfway up a hillside as to better appreciate the bubonic green hills. No sign of Inanek, and I'm totally welcoming the fresh air's lack of medieval town stench. Down the hill I see several cultivated fields, and in the distance, a strip of brown that could be a road. The meadow ends in a wall of green forest smattered with yellow and orange deciduous trees trying to get a jump on autumn. The scene skews Hallmark greeting card rather than beware these woods, and even with whatever was up with Dryden's machinations, I have a good feeling about us locating the missing sheep. Then I spot the white and red patch at the forest's edge. I start towards it, my bandmates following. As we approach, a low buzzing fills the air, accompanying a musky smell. We find the first sheep, or what's left of it, bloodied and crawling with flies. Further evidence that this was not a natural death, the bones and hoof of one leg had been dragged into the forest, and the remaining limbs sprawled outward, pushed aside to get at the sheep's stomach. The skin's been torn away, and bits of intestine cascade out. I'm going to be sick. Micah's voice is scratchy and weak as he takes several steps backwards. I thought you said you were in charge of hunting down meat in your commune. Cole's being a bit too harsh. My stomach's not liking this either. I prefer my protein wrapped in plastic in the grocery cooler. Rabbits, mostly, and they were clean kills, and it was someone else's job to prep the meat. That face. I know what he means. It's gruesome. The angle of the mouth, the way the gums pull back, you could imagine it dying in mid-scream. Or maybe it's rigor mortis. But there's something else off about it. Is it just me? Says Oscar. Or is that head larger than the sheep back home? He's right. It's cow size, maybe. Bigger. I think back to the pixelated livestock from the online version of this world. They hadn't seemed overly large. Horses were normal size for sure, but not everything from the MMORPG version needs to match. Still, I glance at the bison-sized Basil and remember how Dryden had seemed taken aback. Say, Malva, I ask, has Basil always been this big? No, he was the runt of the litter. Malva reaches up, way up, to rub her dog's muzzle. All those people used to tease you, but now that you've gotten your growth spurt, no one's going to make fun of you anymore, are they, Basie? A tongue the size of her hand laps at her face. Exactly when did he get his growth spurt? A couple of weeks ago, the same time the sheep got big. We had to cut a larger door to get them out of the barn. Is that normal for around here? Asked Micah. No, at least I haven't heard of it happening before. So, for unexplained reasons, I say slowly, your animals all suddenly got big. Yes. Way to bury the lead, Mavel. It could have been a wizard spell, or maybe it was a god or the divine wisdom's will. Either way, it's a bit of luck for me. I'm going to get a bunch more wool this winter, once you find them. She glances down at the carcass. Once you find the rest. I look at the size and depth of the cuts in the dead sheep and wonder if more than Mavel's livestock were supersized. And it could just be the sun going down behind a cloud, but there's a chill to the air, and it's looking darker there under those trees.
Gruesome. She's not the brightest cookie in the jar, is she?
She is not.
All right. So everyone's getting bigger, or all the animals are getting bigger?
In this case, the animals are getting bigger. The idea is that they will run into whatever took down the sheep, and it will be much larger than it's supposed to be.
Cool. So it seems as if the thing that gets revealed in terms of like faulty information is she's not that bright and she hasn't revealed information about the size of the animals like she should have.
I don't know if it's revealed that she's not that bright. She's meant to be somebody that just really doesn't think too heavily about stuff. But it's definitely meant that they thought that they were coming to a forest edge to hunt down some sheep, when in fact, there's been some magic going on and one of the sheep is dead already.
That was done well. I'm just like, yeah, okay, we were looking for sheep and we found one. Oh, gross. Oh, and then now there's a bigger conundrum. There's a bigger plot.
And a lot of this was there to begin with, but it was done more for just general comedy than necessarily increasing tension.
Oh, because I could feel the tension. So what kind of changes did you make?
Well, first of all, I put my scene goal at the front.
Oh, which one was that?
That was, I have a good feeling about us locating the missing sheep.
There you go. That is definitely a scene goal, and it is outwardly stated.
And then I immediately follow up. And then I spot the white and red patch of the forest's edge.
That one I caught too. Okay, yeah.
So we got some new information there that they were not aware of. And then I just tweaked a bunch of stuff. I expanded the conversation where she reveals that, yes, everything's gotten bigger recently, to just really emphasize, like, you know, how strange this was.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I finished up the scene. Originally, it was just, it ended with more than marvelous livestock had gotten supersized. And I added, and then it could just be the sun going down beyond the cloud, but there was a chill in the air and it looked darker under those trees. So a little bit.
It was like an ominous.
Yeah. This has to end on a disaster. And so the disaster is them finding out that something bigger killed these sheep than they were necessarily thinking it was going to be.
The disaster, which heightens the tension, is more of an impending doom. Like, we can already kind of guess what we're going to find.
And this is, I have a series of scenes in the action sequences. It's not just leading up to one disaster. There's a whole bunch of smaller disasters. So the disaster here is, there's something bigger than we thought. So we were wrong.
It's a no and. Yes, we found the sheep. No, it's not alive. And there's some, you know, magical hijinks going on, changing the size of the animals. And there's something out there.
Right. And I just put the bit of the ominous clouds and stuff in there just to kind of, like, you know, say, okay, now things are serious.
I think that was done well. Mm-hmm. I like that. This sets up pretty well. It is a short scene, but it's got a lot going on in it.
Yeah.
Like a lot of important things going on, and you really highlighted those things well.
I think we've been writing enough that we know that you have to include that kind of stuff into a scene. You have to make it interesting to the reader. And so I've usually included stuff that builds. So I suspect I have a lot of the examples he uses or he suggests in things already.
So do you think Bickham would be happy with this? I think he would.
Yeah, this definitely hits the reveal something else that the protagonist did not know going into it.
This definitely feels like a Bickham scene as well. Like, this is very Bickham. You've adopted the Bickham's methods for scene building. And it's kind of like your default now.
When I do my editing, I'm really going to focus on each scene or each part of a scene and really try to bring that out with a scene goal and a disaster at the end.
I mean, that's part of your process now. These questions that he has, these like guidelines that he's given for scenes. It's part of your process for both writing and revision.
You know, actually, I think it's not quite as much for writing yet. Mm. Like for me, just getting it out of my head, I can't be thinking on the top of that. You know, if it pops out, it pops out. But really, as I'm writing this first draft and just trying to get through it, I'm just trying to get the plot details down and not worrying too much about the Bickham process. I think that's going to be very much the second draft.
So are you going to write them down on note cards for the revision, like your scene goal and then the disaster and the conflict, to make sure you're like, you're staying on track? Or are you just like, no, as long as I've got those things in there and I'm determined to get them in there for every scene in my revision?
I think I've been using a lot of the commenting options on the side of the draft and just take it from there.
So the edit function.
Yeah, some of the technology that's available for us now. But if I need to, I will pull out the note cards.
Awesome. Well, I thought this was well done. It's like the poster child of the Bickham rising tension scene.
What I loved about it was that I had something that was almost there, and I got to use the techniques, and I got it done, and it did not take that much time.
Nice. Nice. It's always nice when the homework doesn't take a long time.
Yes, that is nice. And so we have your scene for...
No, I did a sequel because I'm like, oh, she did a scene. So she sent this to me last night, dear listener. And I was like, oh, she did the scene one. I'll do a sequel one.
All righty. So we will be doing that for our bonus podcast.
So if you join us on Patreon, you can get our bonus episodes and you can hear Kim workshop my sequel. And just to let you know, it's the sequel with the kind of cliff ending where it says, and then I knew what to do next. So if you want to see that in action, you'll have to join us on Patreon. It's only $3 a month to get those episodes.
And other ways that you guys can support us is our podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and all that. If you're listening to us through one of those services, make sure you subscribe. If there's an option like an Apple Podcast, leave a review. Please leave a review. That makes a big difference in people noticing us. And most of all, if you have a friend that is a writer and you think they might enjoy these podcasts, please recommend it.
Yeah.
Send them a link physically, like, you know, text them the link. So all you do is click on the link in there on their phone or device and listen to us.
And don't forget to check out the show notes. I mean, a lot of people say the word show notes and it's just a bunch of links. Ours have quite a bit more on there that are to help writers challenge themselves, but also really understand the concepts that are in these chapters. So don't forget to go to www.wordstowritebypodcast.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much. You guys have a great day.
All right. See you later. Yes, I say that every time.
I know. It's okay.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smiga-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
After giving out those templates...
I don't think we should keep going. It sounds so bad. It's loud. Leaf blower. Hi, leaf blower.
It is full.